and welcome to Hysteria. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
Alyssa, new research published this Monday in the journal Animal Cognition. Are you a subscriber to Animal Cognition, by the way?
No, but I think I should be.
I feel like you should subscribe to Animal Cognition. Anyway, so there's new research published in Animal Cognition this week that found that cats recognize the goofy voice
Yes.
that their owners have for them.
Okay, this is wonderful because you always kind of hope it's true when I'm like, chonk, come on, chonk. Or it's like, come on, baby tiny cat. Like, they all have their own voice. I have so many voices in one day, and I'm glad to know I'm not just doing it for myself.
No, and you know what? It was actually reassuring when I was reading a write-up of this research that most cat owners do this. We're not insane. We are collectively, but we're not like, none of us are outliers, you know?
Wait, what's Eleanor's voice?
Oh, I'm not doing it.
That's fine. See, that's fine.
No, I do have like I made a parody James Taylor song, but I rewrote it to be about a very pretty kitty, and I turned it through. That's all I'm going to say. It's like too silly. It's too silly.
Okay, that's fine.
This week, we're joined by Lorena Austin, Kara Klenk, and Dana Schwartz to take on the following questions. Why is anti-Semitism being used as a political tool again? What's it like running for state office against some of the nuttiest GOP candidates in the country? Are books an accessory, a message, or both? And when will these desperate fundraising emails stop? All this and more right now. Alyssa, I had a bad experience last night. You want to hear about it?
Please tell me.
Okay, so I heard the NBC News election night theme song last night.
Oh, no.
And the way my body reacted, I felt like I'd eaten like a very spicy meal and then done some cartwheels. It was like heartburn instantly.
Agree.
Instantly. Like, okay, so we're 2 weeks out from the election, less than 2 weeks out from election day. We're much longer than that from knowing how this whole election pans out, despite the efforts of cable news to be like, this is an event that we can tell the story of within a night. No, we can't. We absolutely can't.
No.
People are already voting early in a lot of places. State level polling is so unreliable that it's like functionally useless. And punditry about voter sentiment is, I would say, worse than useless.
Agree. It's nearly wrong.
It's like opposite of helpful. And I was thinking last night after I heard the song about the NBC heartburn song about how Republicans have claimed the economy and crime as things they're good at handling. And it drives me absolutely nuts.
I watched some of the debates last night and it was 100%. It was like, Lee Zeldin, get that out of your mouth. It is the every time they brought something up, he's like, let's go back to the economy. It's like, dude, shut up. You literally have nothing to offer right now.
Very recent history shows us that Republicans are absolute dog shit at both crime and the economy.
Right.
Like, I can't believe that, like, mainstream media has been hoodwinked enough to be like, oh, yes, 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 Republicans. Oh, yes, 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 economy.
And it was, well, they had, because, again, garbage. But there was the poll that came out a couple days ago that said, like, 71% of respondents said they prefer Republicans to deal with the economy. Did they only survey Elon Musk? Like, who are these respondents?
I think that the bigger question is, what do you think Republicans are going to do with the economy that makes you believe that they're better? Are they just saying that they're better at the economy? Like, what concrete things have Republicans said that lead you to believe that they're actually going to be good at the economy? And, like, let's take a look at what happened over in the UK.
Oh.
Obviously, huge differences between our different systems of government, but former Prime Minister Liz Truss, blink and you miss her, did some pretty Republican-style things.
Yeah.
Huge tax cut for the rich. Unsupported energy vouchers. Like, a bunch of stuff that wasn't paid for. Just, like, absolutely tanked the British economy. Like,
and she's gone.
And she's gone. And now there's somebody in there who is going to try very similar ideas to tackle the same problems. And they're probably not going to work because these things do not work.
No.
It's bad economics. And so anyway, after I heard the NBC election night song, which right now is playing in my head like a nightmare that is stalking me, I just wanted to take a second to say next month is going to be very annoying.
So annoying.
Actively participating in American democracy in its current form is a deeply annoying
exercise. And I am tired, and you are tired, and everybody is tired, but fuckery never sleeps. Fuckery never sleeps.
No. Fuckery is 24/7, 365.
And so we don't get to sleep either. Just prepare for this next month to be very annoying. Leave it all on the field. Work as hard as you can up until election day and maybe after if you're somebody who deals in election law. But fuckery never sleeps, so we don't get to sleep either. Okay. Pivoting to news story number one, anti-Semitism. It's back.
It's never really left, but it's badder than ever.
It's worse than ever. So it's in headlines right now because Kanye West made a series of anti-Semitic remarks during interviews and on social media. And as a result, he's been dropped by Adidas and Balenciaga and
Foot Locker and The Real Real.
And Foot Locker. Okay. Okay. Yeah, he's not saying great things. This comes mere weeks after the House GOP caucus tweeted, what was it, Elon, Yeezy?
Who's the last one?
Who's the third one? Putin?
No,
not Putin.
Those two were enough.
Anyway, tweeted out their support of those two people who I would say are, yeah, I don't know if it's just me, but I feel like Elon and Kanye are two individuals who, for different reasons, can't really be relied on to act in a rational manner and don't seem like they're acting in a rational manner. Like Kanye appears very dysregulated to me right now.
No, I mean, consequences at least of his actions, Adidas dropping him. And I just have to say, fucking good for you, Adidas. You finally found God on this one. Like, it took them days to do anything. And you know what? It's like, and they leaked it. You know, it's all over the media. Oh, they're going to have to take a $250 million hit for doing the right thing. You know what? It's worth mentioning, I don't know, a company that does real things like Patagonia, Yvon Chouinard, donating, putting the company in trust so that proceeds benefit the environment. Mm-hmm. And Adidas is like, oh my God, we're going to miss $250 million. Though the one good thing is that by them dropping him, aside from it being the right thing, is that he's no longer a billionaire because it was apparently like $400 million of his wealth. So, I mean, I guess that's good.
Yeah, I will say Adidas was founded by a member of the Nazi Party. So,
yeah. They should have seen this. Like, also years ago, Kanye said something to the effect of, like, I could say a bunch of anti-Semitic shit and Adidas wouldn't drop me. Okay, if you're the company that he said that about and then he actually says the anti-Semitic shit, I just feel like you have to respond faster than they did.
You got to prep a rapid response for that, like you're pre-writing an obituary for a very old celebrity.
100%.
You know, you get that happening. You got to just, you're like, okay, you know what? He's put that out there. Let's prep our rapid response for the inevitable time that we have to drop him. I will say that it's not just Kanye saying stuff.
Right.
There are actual anti-Semitic instances that are on the rise nationwide, according to the Anti-Defamation League. Mm-hmm. There were 2,717 incidents in 2021, which is a 34% rise from the year before.
Yep.
And just, you know, to be fair, 2020, a lot of people were staying inside, not really doing a lot of stuff.
Still.
Publicly, but that is, it should be 0%. We should have a decrease every year, you'd think, as we move toward a world where maybe we're basing our social interactions on empathy and compassion rather than hate and fear, but that's not the world we live in. Good news though, Alyssa.
What?
Kim Kardashian fixed it.
Oh, did she?
On Monday. Just 24 hours before Adidas did the right thing. Kim Kardashian, who does know Kanye, right? They're pals. They know each other.
They are related.
Hate speech is never okay or excusable. I stand together with the Jewish community and call on the terrible violence and hateful rhetoric toward them to come to an immediate end. Wow, Kim, good job. Did Ivanka ghostwrite that for you?
That, I mean, or you can do what the entire extended Kardashian family did, which was just all of them repost the same tile that Jessica Seinfeld had developed, which said, anti-Semitism is fucking wrong. But, like, took everyone in that family a really long time.
Oh, man. They love empty gestures, don't they?
And you know what makes me so mad, Erin, as another sort of data point, is that if we just use Kanye as an example and his Twitter followers, he has 30 million Twitter followers. there are only 15 million Jews in the whole world. So it is a big deal mm-hmm. that, like, these people use their platforms in a way that is, I don't know, mm-hmm. anti-hate.
Yeah, and in L.A., again, in the headlines for embarrassing reasons, mm-hmm. hate groups have been hanging banners on the 405, which is the busiest freeway in L.A. If you're familiar with the city, you avoid the 405 if you possibly can because everybody is always stuck on it. They hung a sign over an overpass that read, "Honk if you know Kanye is right about the Jews," while offering Nazi salutes to oncoming traffic. There's a lot of Jewish people in Los Angeles. Completely unacceptable display. Completely disgusting display. But, you know, people are emboldened to do things like that now. And, it's really scary.
It is. And worth noting that this week we're coming up on the anniversary of the Tree of Life congregation shooting in Pittsburgh.
Ugh. It's really scary and bad.
I was going to say, the thing is, too, these people who hang these anti-Semitic signs and people who want to look the other way, most anti-Semites don't just hate Jews. So please know that hate is coming for everyone. There is something to hate about everyone if you believe that supporting any kind of hate is acceptable.
Right. Anti-Semitism and just straight up white supremacy they share an address. They share a post office.
P.O. Box. Oh my God.
Oh. Wow.
We're not laughing about anti-Semitism, just that we both said P.O. Box.
No, just the fact that our brains are the same thing. And you know, and I was looking at, when I was a kid, I grew up in a part of the country where there wasn't a big Jewish population. Rural Wisconsin, I don't know. Mm-hmm. There's not very many Jewish people there. That maybe this is because of where I grew up. But when I was a kid and even into my 20s, I don't remember seeing headlines of resurgences in anti-Semitism happening so frequently. Like in 2018, there was a resurgence of anti-Semitism right before the election. If you recall, 2020, same deal.
Yeah.
2016. It just feels like every election year now, there are voices in this country that feel emboldened to speak up with anti-Semitic and racist talking points. And it's a bad trend.
I'm against it.
It's terrible. Yeah. Bold for us to come. We're against racism and anti-Semitism. Okay, on to another story that is not a joyful story. Brittany Griner, WNBA star basketball player, is still in prison. A Moscow court rejected her appeal of her 9-year sentence on drug charges on Tuesday, which was an anticipated result in the trial, which was also kind of a sham trial because it's Russia. U.S. officials say they believe that eventually Griner will get sent home in a prisoner swap. Mm. But the whole process has been really frustrating to everybody. Her friends, her fans, her family, her loved ones, everybody here. And it's just very frustrating to watch.
It is. And they say now she may be transferred to a penal colony, which is much more remote. And I can't imagine what that is like.
Yeah. So she's been incarcerated for more than 8 months already. And her immediate concern is how quickly she'll be transferred out of that penal colony.
Yep.
She is supposed to serve out her term in one, but is currently in a relatively safer jail in Moscow. So hoping we get her out of there ASAP. Okay. Final story before we take a break and get to our interview today. This is just a trio of bad ones.
It is.
Bad stories. U.S. students in most states and in almost all demographic groups have experienced big setbacks in both their math and reading scores, according to a national exam, which was released on Monday, which shows that remote learning during the pandemic and closing down the schools was actually really harmful mm-hmm. to students. What do you make of this, Alyssa?
I mean, it makes sense. You know, I think that we're just not just – I feel like this is just the beginning of us seeing sort of the impact that the 2 years of COVID that we have gone through have impacted people. And it's everything from the remote learning, but not just the remote learning. It is when the kids did have to do remote learning, who had, you know, relatively reliable broadband and Wi-Fi to be able to mm-hmm. actually learn. Mm-hmm. And Yeah. And this was based on, I think, fourth graders and eighth graders. Mm-hmm. And a meager 26% of eighth graders were proficient from the expectation, which is down, though worth noting, though, too, down from 34% in 2019. So it is a drop, but it is not like it's not like they were, anyone was clocking in at 75% prior to the pandemic, right, which is also bad, but worse now.
Yeah. Can I try and like identify a possible silver lining here?
What is that?
Okay, possible silver lining here is we have the raw data now that shows how important schools are to student achievement.
Yes.
School cannot be reduced to something kids only go to a couple days a week or do entirely remotely. It is not acceptable for us to, as a country, to continue to cut resources that are supposed to go to teachers and schools. What we need are well-funded, well-trained, well-supported schools that children can attend in person. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, our entire country will suffer. So, you know, I think that maybe a silver lining to this is that we've talked about on this show before how Republicans and conservatives really would love to gut the education system so much that it becomes a privatized, effectively like a privatized thing that people need to pay for.
Right.
And we are so far from that being something that anybody would stand for, given how much kids performance suffered when they didn't have access to like their public schools in person. So this, I think, actually shows that what we need is to better equip and better fund our schools and make sure that kids can attend schools in person, because that kids can't learn like
right
just over a computer.
No.
And I feel like the ones that did probably had at least one parent who just drove themselves to the brink of insanity.
Totally.
Trying to support their kids being like teachers and working full time. And usually that's, you know, the mom that did that. So yeah, in-person school necessary. Otherwise, this is going to happen over and over again.
Yes.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, a great interview. And welcome back. Alyssa, you and I talk about this a lot, how important it is to pay attention to what is going on at the local and state level, wherever you are.
Vitally important. Vitally important.
That's where, I mean, look, is our national politics kind of glamorous?
Also corroded. Terrible.
Yeah, totally. But like, who gets the shit done? The people at the local and state level. And so we're really excited to welcome our guest today. Today's guest is running for the Arizona State House in the new competitive District 9. The State House is controlled by the GOP right now, but this fifth-generation Arizonan might change that. They have an ambitious agenda, but this former Mesa Community College student body president is no stranger to working hard to meet ambitious goals. Lorena Austin, welcome to Hysteria.
Thank you so much for having me. I mean, this is such an important space and place. I'm super excited to be here.
We're excited to have you. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you wanted to run for the Arizona State House?
Yeah, it's been a long journey. And if you'd asked me even in January if I was going to run, that would not have been the case because I was applying to law school this year. And when I found out about this new district, it literally could not have been drawn up any more perfectly than the space and neighborhood that my family's resided in for over 100 years on my father's side. And so in that time, too, in this 100 years, they've also been very involved in community activism. My nana and tata owned a grocery store here, which was a segregated neighborhood at the time called the Washington Escobedo Park neighborhood. They owned a little tiendita, and they were big champions for our community. I mean, they helped change some blue code laws. They were well known for always being there and providing assistance, and even goes as far to helping people find housing and shelter and being able to stay here and support families. That, you know, service-minded attitude really passed on to my father, and he ended up becoming a civil rights attorney. He was also involved in the Chicano movement, as well as my mother. They met in the Bay Area. And so service and advocacy to your community has always been something very strong in my life. And I'm so lucky to have had that exemplified to me. On my mom's side of the family, they come from very working, hard class roots. My grandmother, who's my biggest idol inspiration, was a farm worker for most of her life. And so, again, someone, you know, who taught me to work hard and show up for my community. My mom is also a social worker and teacher. And, you know, that has just kind of always been something that I aspired to be, not necessarily a political leader, but someone who could just really advocate for their community because we know our community. And so, again, when this race kind of opened up, I just really thought, you know, someone who's actually from here, who understands our community, who's built those relationships and is so passionate about it. Like, I live here, I work here, I volunteer here. This is my home. And I want to make sure that it, you know, stays that way for community members here in LD9.
You know, there's something special about teachers' kids. We've said that a lot on this pod. We're made of something, and not just because I'm a teacher's kid, too. But
yeah,
I feel like we run into a lot of teachers' kids, and they all have a little bit of something extra. So Phoenix's metro area has the highest inflation rate in the country, which, you know, not a great distinction. Polls say that the economy and inflation are the problems that voters care about the most. So what is Mesa already doing to address this issue, and how would you aid those efforts in office?
Yeah, I think there's things we could be doing at the state level that would really help ease some of this burden off of our constituents. So here in Mesa, and then we do have two precincts of Tempe that is just sit on the west side of the town. But I think, you know, we've talked to our local leaders and housing is a big issue and local municipalities and cities not being able to have that control and having to work with developers to provide, you know, more housing and affordable housing. And for me, destigmatizing what affordable housing looks like, because if you think about it too, that looks like me right now. I'm a first time generation home buyer and I'm, you know, disenfranchised because I can't compete with other people that have more capital than me. I work multiple jobs as an educator. I don't make $0 and I work really hard, but I don't make enough now to buy a 1200 square foot, $500,000 home in this district that my family's called home for, you know, a century. So we could be doing different things, especially on the housing level. Working in higher education, I think of retraining, right, constantly. And we talk about, you know, climate and Arizona should be the, you know, most clean energy, sustainable energy, you know, moving forward in the future with how much, you know, solar we have. So retraining our residents here to ensure that they have better paying jobs and being able to compete in what we now see. But yeah, we had the third fastest growing economy inflation here in Arizona, and we are the third bottom for resources like affordable housing and resources that could really help our residents here. So there's a lot of things we could be doing. But what I tell people, I don't try to make these huge grand promises, is I can't do those things if we can't at least tie or flip. Certainly can't do those things as a legislator, too, if we're electing, you know, extreme state slate here in Arizona as well. So there's a lot of things we need to do. And so knowing that, too, that obviously I'm hoping for a blue wave and I'm confident in that, but I'm also very pragmatic, especially being a community advocate, is I have to know, you know, those options and what's ahead of us. And so I have to still be thinking of how I can impact my community in the most effective way.
Lorena, your state has proposed lots of anti-abortion and anti-LGBTQ plus legislation. Can you give our listeners some examples of those legislation and tell us how you think your voice would impact the conversation in the House?
Yeah, it's been very extreme. And, you know, people are talking about this at the doors. And when I go up to a door and introduce myself and talk about, find that common ground between us, whether that's a community focused lens or just something in common that we have. And then I ask, you know, what's important to you? And man, if it's not abortion, education issues, I mean, the community is talking about it. So in terms of abortion, and that might be surprising to people who think of Arizona as the Wild Wild West, but people understand how important that life-saving healthcare is. And even more, I think importantly, is even men are the ones that bring it up too at some of the doors, which I think has been interesting. So the issue on abortion has really galvanized people here in Arizona because they understand the implications that it has. I mean, this will cost people their lives. There's no exceptions for rape or incest, and that's just absolutely unacceptable and draconian, right? And so it's definitely on the minds of people. And again, I mean, that's the importance of having a legislature that is going to listen to the will of the people, because we've had time and time and again in Arizona, if you're familiar, especially when we talk about education and funding education, we've had Prop 208, which was a bipartisan, you know, overwhelming effort that people said they wanted to fund education. And then the legislature said, no, too bad. You really don't know what you're talking about. And what kind of legislature is that? We talk about a tax on our trans youth and the LGBTQIA community. I mean, that's a community I'm a part of. And I'll tell you, as someone who went through public school education, you could not have found a more heteronormative education, you know, to be imposed upon somebody. And I still, you know, am very queer. So this idea that we're entering this stage that's just influencing children to be in this demonic education is just unfounded. grounded and unreal. And if anything, we need to understand that this community, and especially children, they should be in a safe place where they're accepted and heard. And that's what we're talking about, accepting these communities, because we know that 50%, and I think that statistic's probably low, of young people that identify in this community consider suicide. I mean, because they're not accepted in their communities. That's unacceptable. I mean, how can we live with ourselves thinking in this way? And thankfully, you know, I'll be honest, that crossed my mind. And I'm so grateful that I had a support system of friends and community that, you know, and I'm here and I'm so proud to represent this community. And I hope that I inspire others to know that, you know, they can succeed, they can be prosperous, they can lean on one another and really be authentically who they are. So what we're talking about is I'm advocating for children to be authentically who they are and to be loved and supported. And I think that's the job of education. And that's the job of legislators, to ensure that every one of their constituents are not just 18 and above who can vote for them. They're every single individual, no matter their age. And we need to be advocating to them and listening to them and supporting them. Mm-hmm.
I want to get into the education piece, but I also wanted to follow up on something that you said about men bringing up abortion. I would love to hear more about how those conversations go. Like, are they concerned in a way that you haven't encountered before? Like, how do they bring it up with you?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's something that, you know, women and individuals who become pregnant, that's something that has always been on our minds, because we understood that abortion was on the line and what that meant inherently. And then when it happened, I think some men really understood, wow, the impact that that could have, you know, on themselves. And so at the doors, I have been surprised a few times when I've said, you know, what issues are important to you? And I'll say women's rights, women's healthcare. Because I think, and I ask them to expand upon that, and it's either a sibling of theirs or a loved one or their partner, if they're talking about family planning or just anything, I think shows a little bit that we are holding men accountable as well and having those more difficult conversations. And I applaud, you know, women and individuals who are being fearless and unapologetic about having, you know, this very conversation that impacts our lives directly. So it has been a little bit surprising, but also I've had to have difficult conversations about, yeah, this isn't going to affect you, you know, in the ways that, you know, when someone wants to come at me and be like, well, I don't know if it's a big deal. And I mean, excuse you, you don't think it's a big deal. You don't have, you know, you don't have a woman in your life that this could affect. And as a woman, and I think this is real, like, I know that I could be sexually assaulted at any moment. Like, that sounds, I hope that doesn't sound wild of an idea, but I think as a woman, we know how unprotected we are in this society and how real and serious this is. I could be 1 in 3 any day. And I had that conversation with a close friend of mine, and he was just so taken aback. You know, he's a father, and he was just like, I never thought of that you in your 30s are still thinking of that. And I was like, I don't think that'll ever go away from me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is, I think we all can relate to that pretty hard. And I don't think that you're, like, that's not a wild thing to say. That's something that we're all thinking about all the time. And it's good that men are seeming to be a little bit more empathetic to that now. I wish it would have come before, but glad that it's happening now.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about education. Arizona is in the bottom 5 states for education funding, and you work in education. So why do you think the state doesn't treat this as more of a priority? And what do you think your district would need extra education funding for?
Yeah. So as an educator, I work in higher education, so community colleges, but I see the direct impacts of K-12 funding, you know, coming into our colleges and seeing the unpreparedness that some of the students have. And I don't attribute that to the teachers or, you know, lack of resources they had, but, you know, children, students, college students are taking remedial courses, just might not be as prepared, not really understand how to navigate that system. But here in my district, Mesa Public Schools is the largest public school system in the state. And so what we're going to see from that too is some people might say, well, they're kind of fine right now. I'm like, but you're going to see that lack of funding very quickly in the next few years when we can't, you know, increase infrastructure for some of our crumbling schools. And something I always like to point out about education in public schools, it has never been equitable. So it depends on what side of the tracks you're living in these cities. We're talking about redlining in neighborhoods, and that's very prevalent here in this district as across the country. So obviously there's some public schools that are way better off than others. And so I always try to point that out as well. There's already schools that have had lack of resources, unfortunately. And so looking at those both and situations, I think is really important in that conversation. That's what really gets me going sometimes, is that we have never been, you know, doing a great job on that front. And so in terms of two of this funding, why they don't fund it, I mean, it's a very polarizing political issue. I mean, we just expanded vouchers, which we don't have a two-tiered system for education funding. And so those vouchers literally siphon just millions of dollars from our public schools. And so this is kind of this very long term. It's been happening for decades, but now it's really coming to this like precipice where young families are very, very big part of my district. And, you know, they're asking me about like, hey, I want my child to go to a good school. And the foundation of our neighborhoods are surround schools. I mean, especially here in my area, you can't go, you know, to a neighborhood without running into the elementary school. And I walk these neighborhoods. And so it's something very fundamentally important. And something that we address, like we have this archaic 1980 aggregate expenditure limit that caps education funding at a certain price point, right? And we're in the 21st century now. I mean, just think of technology advancements and think of all the new resources that we need. We're in a teacher crisis right now. We have over 50,000 people that are eligible to teach, but don't, because they know that they're not going to have that support. They won't have these resources. And time again, I mean, I wouldn't be on the ballot without teachers. A teacher in particularly who literally took me around. Her name's Christina Bustos. She's a powerhouse. She took me to get my first signature from a neighborhood and taught me so much. So again, teachers are this life force in my campaign and just everything that we do. But I am so beside myself that every year we expect our teachers to come and just simply advocate for basic funding that they need to support our future and our students, staff and teachers.
Your opponent, Marianne Mendoza, has been making headlines because pictures of her in blackface. Why do people keep doing this?
Why do people keep doing this?
Why? You know, to quote my own book title, who thought that was a good idea? And you called for her to withdraw from the race. How has campaigning against her been?
I will be super honest. So it's herself and Kathy Pierce, because there's two House seats here. And my running mate, Seth Blattman, and I, we haven't seen them. To be completely honest, they have not shown up to our debates.
What?
It's kind of like they lie in wait, I guess, and just maybe. And maybe they're in different circles, obviously. But in this district, it's a pattern. It's a historical pattern. So Kathy Pierce's brother is Russell Pierce, who is the only recalled legislator in the state of Arizona who was the author of discriminatory bills like SB 1070. So with Joe Arpaio and the immigration sweeps that terrorized our community so much that a bipartisan effort to oust him was prevailed and he was ousted. So she's running. And then we have Marianne Mendoza, who is, this pattern is just normal for her. I mean, she can't have Twitter because she kept posting anti-Semitic white nationalist viewpoints. And
oh my gosh, you can't make this stuff up.
You can't. And got cut from an RNC video or speaking lineup because you're too racist. And that's saying a lot.
Oh my God. I mean, that's not funny, but it's very funny.
It's not right.
It's funny what the WTF.
Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's WTF funny. It's not like ha-ha funny. Oh, my goodness.
Right.
You can't make it up. And, you know, the Senate candidate to this area, Robert Scantlebury, they're all just, you know, spew the same rhetoric back and forth. And we had said, you know, before the primaries, we're like, man, we think we probably have the most extreme, you know, candidates here in this district at that time. And then the primaries happened. It was like, oh no, it's the whole state. So unfortunately, but I would say, you know, very frankly, that they are not representative of this district. I mean, West Mesa is diverse. There's so many different experiences and backgrounds, religious, you know, ethnic wise. And it's just no resemblance to the place that I call home and have known for so long. So it's just mind boggling to me that someone who's like running to create policy for not just their community, but the state is going to just continually spew racist rhetoric and ideologies and propaganda. And I can't imagine how this person would keep in mind her constituents when writing policy. So we always talk about how we're running to represent everybody. It doesn't matter the letter next to your name. I don't care if it's Republican, Independent, Democrat. I will talk to anyone because I believe in those constructive, really hard conversations. I believe in building trust in a community that for so long has been disenfranchised. And that was, you know, another reason that I ran, because unfortunately, I didn't see anyone from a political party, you know, in my neighborhood. And I've been very upfront about that with the Dem Party. You know, I didn't know what an LD was. I didn't know what a PC was. I went to an LD meeting and I asked, you know, they probably thought I was just wild. Like, I don't know what a PC is. And they're probably like, this person's running for office. But again, it really spoke to me. I know who's doing unsheltered advocacy in Pioneer Park, a large park we have here. I know who's doing community development and helping small business loans during COVID. I mean, that's what I think of when I think of community advocacy. And that's what I want to bring. You know, I'm running not because I'm some political party savior. That's not me. But I think there's resources that could be dedicated to my community that aren't getting there because that relationship hasn't been built. And that takes time too. So it's a whole thing. But back to, I'm sorry, I just got totally flipped there. But back to, you know, Maryam Mendoza and Kathy Pierce. I mean, you couldn't pick two people that were more unrepresentative of our community, period, the end. They're not running to represent everybody. They're running to represent a faction of people that think like them and only them. And that ideology and their perspective will hurt people. It will harm people. And that's why we can't have them representing this district.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that you bring up a really important point, which is that if people who are outside of Arizona or outside of the West just judged Arizona by the headlines that their more wild party nominees were making, they would think Arizona was just like a bunch of Facebook posts like fighting. But, you know, I live in California. I've spent some time in Arizona. I know it's a great state with great people in it. It's more than just a bunch of angry boomers fighting on Facebook. So as a longtime Arizonan, what do you think is your favorite thing about your state? And what do you think your state's best kept secret is?
Oh my gosh. Man, if you haven't seen an Arizona sunset, you're missing out. It is like one of the most beautiful, consistently beautiful things in the world. What I love so much about Arizona and my community is, you hear me say community all the time, because that's literally just how I live and breathe. But an example of that is how community comes together regardless. And I live in a place where for so long, community has had to depend on one another and not a government entity to save them. And so for me, I see that a lot. And that has been exemplified to me in a lot of ways. But when COVID happened, I had come back to college after 10 years and I graduated in 2020 and then it was COVID. And that was like just my call to action. I mean, I'd always been involved, but like that was really like, okay, I'm doing what I know how to do best. And I volunteered at the food bank. I did the intake for 3,000, helped 3,000 cars coming through and no one really knew what was going on and just helping people get food. But also my incredible friends at Republic Empanada, who are family friends of mine for decades, when the dining room areas were shut down, they made it a collection space and center for indigenous communities up north. Because at that time, Doctors Without Borders were coming to Arizona. Like how embarrassing. Indigenous communities up north in Arizona had the highest rates of COVID-19. And it was people like my friends. And we decided to, you know, collect these supplies. It was toiletries, food, PPE. And we did it for months. And we would get pallets of water from Costco. We'd have to rent these trucks and take it all the way up to, you know, these indigenous rural communities. And that's the type of community that I think really comes to the forefront. Something that I love so much about, you know, my not just my district, but I think Arizona. And you're right, you know, if people were to look at Arizona, even my very close friends are like, what the hell is going on? Like you all just pick off of each other, right? There's like Texas, Arizona, Florida, what the fuck, right? And that's what I love to show people is that at the end of the day, the residents here and the communities are so resilient because they've always had to be. And that's what they know. And that's what they do best. Is band together when everything is so dire, when there's a global pandemic, you know that someone from your community is going to step up and do the right thing. But not because they want to, because we have to, we need to. Like, how are we going to survive otherwise if not, you know, leaning on each other? So that's my favorite part about Arizona.
Oh, Well, Lorena Austin, you've sold me on the state of Arizona. Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck in the election coming up. We will be keeping an eye on it and hope to have you back when you are a state legislator.
Would love that. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time and efforts and, you know, keep up the good work. I appreciate you both.
We have to take a break, but before we do that, Witch of the Week. Alyssa, who's this week's Witch of the Week?
I've got a witch, Erin. You know, you love Utah the way I love Hawaii. Mm. And so this week we have Pele. In Hawaiian mythology, Pele is the creator of the Hawaiian Islands. Her name means she who shapes the sacred land, which she does with volcanoes and their molten lava. Mm. Legend goes that Pele herself journeyed on her canoe from the island of Tahiti to Hawaii. When on her journey, it was said she tried to create her fires on different islands, but her sister, Namaka, was chasing her, wanting to put an end to her. In the end, the two sisters fought each other, and Pele was killed. With this happening, her body was destroyed, but her spirit lives on at Kilauea on the Big Island. They say that when she's angry, she'll explode. Her body is the lava and steam that comes from the volcano. In addition to her role as goddess of fire, Pele is also regarded as the goddess of hula. Who doesn't love hula?
Wow. Aspirational and relatable. The steam, the molten lava.
Totally. And dancing to celebrate the steam and molten lava. An urban legend states that Tutu Pele, which is what she is called as a sign of respect, herself occasionally warns locals of impending eruptions, appearing in the form of either a beautiful young woman or an elderly woman with white hair, sometimes accompanied by a small white dog, but always dressed in a red muumuu. Pele is said to walk along the roads near Kilauea, but will vanish if passerbys stop to help her. According to the legend of Pele's curse, her wrath will fall on anyone who removes items from her island. Every year, tourists return small natural items from the islands to seek Pele's forgiveness. It is believed Pele's curse was invented in the mid-20th century to deter tourist depredation.
Okay, well, that's a really good invention. I support that type of mis and disinfo if it convinces people to not be assholes when they're visiting Hawaii.
Right. Don't take the lava rocks, bitches.
Yeah, leave them. Pele is going to get mad at you for sure. Okay, great Witch of the Week. That was a fun month of Witches of the Week.
Yeah. We'll have to find another season of witches to celebrate.
Yeah. Maybe we could just do it on like solstices and equinoxes or
something good, because witches are cool. There are so many witches we can't even get to.
So many female figures in folklore that are sometimes nice, but usually scary.
A little saucy, little axe to grind.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, you know, I respect all of those traits. Okay, let's take a quick break. When we come back, personal political.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food. And before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back. I want to start today's segment by quoting a tweet from one of our panelists. Alyssa, I think you'll recognize this because I think I've brought this tweet up before. Here's the tweet. It's from 2017, and I had to, like, Google it, and I found it. Bell, there goes the baker with his tray like always. Baker, well, there goes Bell singing her daily mean song about us. That's Dana Schwartz.
It's a throwback.
It's a throwback from Dana Schwartz. Dana is a New York Times bestselling author. Her new book, Immortality, A Love Story, is available for pre-order. It helps authors.
It helps so much that the publishing people are just like on their knees being like, Dana, please tell the people to pre-order. So I'm telling you, please.
The holidays are coming up. You can just like give a printout of the beautiful cover art and be like, this is what I've pre-ordered for you for Christmas.
It's thoughtful. It really is.
It's like you found a printer. You found a printer and you printed something out for me. And you also pre-ordered a book. It's a very good book. So, Dana, we're really excited to have you today. Rounding off the panel, her podcast, That's Messed Up, an SVU podcast, is coming to the Midwest in November. And her show, Better Half Comedy, is in LA every Wednesday. Kara Klenk, welcome to Hysteria.
Thanks for having me back, guys. It's always a shock every time I get the invite to return.
How you been? What have you been up to?
Me, I have been touring with my podcast. So I actually just got back 2 days ago and I was gone for 9 days, which is the longest I've ever left my kids before. But my husband was able to fly his parents in to obviously help him because men can do nothing alone. And but yeah, it was great. It was really fun to go to. We were in the South. We were like, well, we started in DC and then we were in like North Carolina, Alabama, Atlanta, and Nashville. And it was great. It was fun to meet all the people that listen and, you know, get out on the road.
Do you ever find that when you immerse yourself too much in like crime media that you start to have like nightmares about crime?
Oh, of course. Yes. Completely. Like we used to like research the crimes right before bed and I started having nightmares and I was like, I gotta stop doing that.
Yeah.
And also, like, my co-host Lisa makes fun of me because I'm always like, now that I have kids, SVU hits a little different. And she's like, oh, so child murder was okay before? And I'm like, no, it wasn't. But now I have like a specific child that I, two children that I care about that I'm like, the world is terrible. But, you know, obviously I still keep plugging along because I do love the show and the content. But yes, that stuff does fully give me nightmares. And I think you just get more paranoid in general. Uh-huh. Like, I don't know. You're like, what's that guy doing? You know, just like, you know,
right. I don't like the cut of his jib.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the reason I brought up Dana's tweet at the top of this segment is because today we're talking about like projecting intelligence. And the first fictional character that came to mind when we were talking about signifying intelligence was Belle from Beauty and the Beast, who really, the longer I sit with this animated film that I first watched in 1994, I want to say, the more I'm like, Belle really was high on the smell of her own farts. She really thought that she was like the smartest person ever. And it also kind of came to mind this week because we were talking about like book talk and the importance of TikTok and social media in selling, both selling books and selling yourself as a reader of books. So I want to kind of get into the ways that we project intelligence or make an effort to look smart and whether those things are like obnoxious or actual helpful social adaptations. Alyssa, have you ever tried to look smart? That sounds like a very mean question. Have you ever even tried?
No, it's fine because now I look like me. But yes, I did for many, many years try to look smart. I mean, there was like the forced professionalism of being a paralegal, which was like, you must just wear a suit. That was different. But like one of my most embarrassing / heartening exchanges with Barack Obama when I first started working for him was when it was 2006 and we were traveling all across the place for the midterms. And I would keep a copy of The Economist magazine with my real magazines inside. And I had People, I had In Touch. I mean, not, let's be honest, it wasn't People. It was like In Touch, Entertainment Weekly.
A fine publication.
Star. Obviously.
Alyssa, not Star.
Entertainment Weekly does not go in the same category.
It was was 20 years ago, Kara.
Alyssa, Star is like a glossy National Enquirer.
Star had better pictures. Anyway, I thought that he was asleep in the back of the car where we were driving. And so I took out The Economist, but took out my real magazines. And he's like, you think I didn't know this? One eye open. He's like, you think I didn't know this? And then we were both like reading the magazines together. He's like, I don't like you and trust you because I think you read The Economist. And I was like, okay, that's good. But that went on for a long time before he found me out. It was like The Economist, The Atlantic, like you name it. I tried to look like I was as smart as I could be.
Yeah. Dana, I would love to hear your thoughts on signifying intelligence because I feel like you have a lot of opinions on Belle and a lot of opinions on Belle-like characteristics in other people. So what, in your mind, is looking smart? What is that? How does that manifest?
I guess I want to make everything I'm about to say, it like comes from a place of self-loathing and insecurity. Like, I do think genuinely a lot of the things that like make me uncomfortable is because it reminds me of myself. And like, I think I have a bad attention span and like, I don't think I'm smart enough or well-read enough, or I think I should dress better. And so, yeah, I definitely see on TikTok, because I'm a youthful child where, you know, I belong on TikTok with among my peers. There's like the trend of like dark academia where people are dressing like they're Oxford grad students. Like that's the aesthetic, like look like you're studying at Oxford, and like books as aesthetic is like a big thing where it's like, I think a lot of social media is like curating a persona that you can put out in the world that's palatable. Like one of them is like that girl or like it girl where it's like, you know, like dewy skincare skin and green smoothies. Or like I'm an intellectual, like New Yorker, like reading the New Yorker, walking on the subway, cool coats. Like I do think that people, when they don't really know themselves, try to curate an aesthetic in the hopes that then the personality will follow. I do want to point out, I have rainbow organized bookshelves, which people don't think is a signifier of intelligence because it's like, oh, she's just using the books as an aesthetic. But it's just because I have a brain that I need to organize things, and I thought it looked nice.
I did clock that because I knew what we were talking about today. And if I may interrupt for 2 seconds.
Of course.
I was originally such a judgy bitch about people doing that. I was like, oh, is that like how your books are organized by color? And now I fully have a shelf like that in my house. It just looks nice. It was just like a better way that like they just don't look good all like the ones that are out for the public, you know?
Mm-hmm. I just saw, I mean, I had like obviously seen it on Instagram and thought it looked cute. And it was like pandemic days. And I used to live in a studio apartment where like my bookshelves were the only thing on that wall. And so I was like, oh, well, it also has to be decor. And also it was very fun for me to like take all my, and like very cathartic to like take all the books out of the shelf and like put them back in order. And now, I mean, it's sort of all over the place. And like, I have books all over my house that aren't organized, but this shelf is sort of the remnant of it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, this other shelf is just nonsense.
Kara, have you ever put effort into like looking smart or projecting intelligence?
These aren't real glasses. These glasses are fake. No, I'm kidding. They are real glasses. No, like, no. Whoa. Actually, I knew a girl that did that in college and I deeply, deeply judged her for it. I was like, I cannot believe you wear glasses that are fake. Like they were just glasses. I don't think I've ever done like a physical outward projection of intelligence that I can think of. Like, but I don't curate my Instagram in the way that I know what Dana's talking about exactly, but I just don't, I don't think I have the time or the eye for it, you know? Mm-hmm. I just don't have the eye to make myself look better than I am on Instagram. But I don't know. I definitely have like a similarly fraught relationship with wanting to seem intelligent, feeling like I'm never as smart as the other people in the room and things like that. But I don't think I don't know. I only started wearing glasses like 7 years ago. And I feel like it sort of did inform a little bit about like what people think of me, at least on stage or like when they see me. And I didn't even realize that was going to happen, but I think it does a little bit, you know?
I will confess, I, in my like cringier days when I was trying to like curate my Instagram more like conscientiously, I would, like, you know, go to a coffee shop and, like, get the latte and, like, spread open my book and, like, take a picture of it. Even if I was only going to, like, read three pages and then be on my phone. Like, I definitely did it. But I think it was as much a signifier to the outside world as a signifier to me that, like, I'm insecure about my own whatever, and I want to be this sort of person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's easy to think about, like, I mean, back when I was maybe, I guess, like, in my 20s, this was kind of in the analog days or just the beginning of social media before people were really curating a persona on social media. But there were signifiers back then that people would kind of, you, like, books as decor, like a copy of Infinite Jest in a place of prominence on your bookshelf, like some Thomas Pynchon novels that with mysteriously uncreased spines.
I could never do that because I live in utter fear that the entire world is just the Socratic method and that someone would come into my house and be like, oh, tell me about that book. And I'd be like, I've never read it. I never read it. I am sorry. So I really, even on my desk right here, I have all these books. I, like, this office is full of books. You don't see any of them because I don't want anyone being like, what did you think of that one, Alyssa?
I mean, it's like when I was younger, I would have not, I mean, I guess I never was paranoid about that. But now when I get done reading books, unless they're like one of my very most favorite books, I usually just, like, get rid of them. I give them away, or there's, like, a bookstore in Echo Park in Los Angeles that sells used books, but it's, like, a really important part of the community. So I'll give my used books to them to sell, and they'll give me, like, a $10 gift card, and I'll get, like, a coffee or whatever. But I don't really have a lot of books in my house that I have already read. So if someone comes over and they're like, oh, what do you think of Vertigo, the book about Mexico City? I'd be like, I haven't read it yet. These are all aspirations for myself.
Oh, interesting. I am married to a bookophile. Like, they are his sports. They are his porn. Like, books are everything to him. Like, if he sees one of our kids pick up one of his books, he's like, no, 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 no. Like, book. He always tells them books are precious. But, like, and I have instituted a one-in-one-out policy with him because he just buys so many books that I'm like, we got to get rid of some of these. So now I have this love-hate relationship with books where I'm like, they're everywhere. Like, they're, but he, like, you know, there's some he likes to keep. But I will admit that I have books that I kept that I've read that I'm like, oh, these do make me look smart to, like, keep these on my section of the bookshelf, which is very small compared to his. But I'll be like, oh, you know, back in your mind, you're like, I took a class on Dante. I have all of Dante's Inferno and Paradise and Purgatory. I have the whole thing, and I, like, have those books there. And it's like, what, am I going to, like, reopen Dante one day? Probably not. But I'm like, oh, this will spark a conversation about how I studied abroad. Like, I don't know. It's so lame.
But those are almost like, this kind of brings up something that's, I think, important. Like, should we hide the fact that we've done those things? Like, that's cool. That's like a trophy. That's like a smart person merit badge.
It's like a memory, yeah. Right? It's like a fridge magnet from, you know, this time. Like, I have a lot of books that I either haven't read yet or read once and will never read again, but, like, they remind me of a specific time. But, like, yeah, like, signed books that I got when I was, like, 16 as a gift, or, like, books that I remember because I, like, interviewed the author for EW, or, like, things that, like, evoke a specific period where it's, like, I keep them more as, like, relics than things I want to read again necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Marie Kondo would really disapprove. Well, no, it's sparking joy. It's
sparking joy for you, yeah.
Yeah.
She did say you're supposed to have, what, like, 10 books? It's something insane.
Ugh.
Oh, Marie.
When we were researching this topic, I was thinking a lot about this episode of MTV Cribs. You guys remember that show?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So there's an episode with MTV Cribs that really stuck out to me that had Moby on it. Remember the DJ?
Of course.
Natalie Portman.
Yeah, that guy.
Do you know, randomly, I know, like, five people who have hooked up with Moby. They're all, like, friends of friends, but, like, every, I know so many people are like, oh, my friend hooked up with Moby.
Oh, man. For a while, I knew a bunch of people who had all hooked up with the guy who played Ray on Girls.
Oh, yeah. He was everywhere in Brooklyn
really?
For a while.
Yeah.
That's unlikely. Unexpected.
Good for him, though. I mean, he did great. He took that role and he
ran with it.
He did great with it. And I didn't hear any creepy stories about him. Just like, yep, we hooked up. It's like, good for you.
Just that he's out there.
That's great.
He's doing research. He's on a show called Girls. He needs to know about Girls.
Yeah. So in this episode of MTV Cribs with Moby in it, Moby has this very insufferable moment, surprise, surprise, where he goes over to his bookshelf and he's like, I just think on this show, nobody ever has any books in their house. So I'm going to tell you about my books. And that has always stuck out to me as like one of the most insufferable moments in MTV history. And I just was, what's the difference between a person who communicates their love of books or reading or, you know, analog consumption of content for as like a social signifier to like make friends and connect with people, and someone who's just doing it to feel superior? Alyssa, you're sort of like looking thoughtful.
No, because I mean, that's the ultimate, that's the distinction. You know what I mean? Like Dana saying, look, I love my books. I have these books. I color code. Like all of us have things that we love, but we love them because we love them, not for the sake of being loved for loving them, mm-hmm. right? And that's the difference with what you just said about Moby. If he had said in MTV Cribs, you know what I'm so proud of? You know, look at these books. I've read all these books, and it's something I'm so proud of. That is cool. Mm-hmm. Saying everyone who has been on this show before me is adult, and I am so smart. Yeah. I am the diversity in your series because look at all of these books. That is the difference.
Did you guys see the Architectural Digest, I think, tour with Ashley Tisdale?
No.
No, I did not.
So she, it sort of went viral for a minute because she was like showing off her brand new house and she had all these bookshelves filled with books. And she was like, I'm going to be really honest with you. The shelves were empty and I told my husband Architectural Digest is coming and we just can't have empty bookshelves. So I just told him to go buy books bulk. So she like said, like, we just moved in. These bookshelves were empty. I knew you were coming. So my husband just bought random books to put in the shelf. And like, honestly, I respect that.
Yes, totally.
I did something similar to that. Like when we moved to LA for the first time, like we lived in West Hollywood and we had all these built-ins in our living room. And my husband reads all this sci-fi and nerdy shit. And I was just like, I don't really want this out on display. The covers are ugly. The spines are ugly. A lot of them are used. Like they just don't look good. So we did go to like Last Bookstore in LA and bought like a bunch of used books that were like Joan Didion and like books that had like nice, like, I will read these, but I bought them initially for like, you know, we got to fill these bookshelves up and I don't want it to be with like Isaac Asimov or whatever books from about, you know, other planets and alien races and stuff.
My little sister, we had that moment where I was in her apartment and like, she has a beautiful apartment because my little sister has excellent taste and she had like this really great, like green coffee table book on the British artist Damien Hirst. And like weirdly through a fluke of like friends of friends, Ian and I on our honeymoon were staying in a house that was owned by Damien Hirst. We don't know him. This was just
was
like a weird.
Was it like skull shaped and encrusted in crystals?
Yeah. Weirdly, it wasn't. It was just normal. There was like no art or anything.
Ooh, disappointing.
Whatever. But I told Hallie that. I was like, oh my God. Like, do you know, like weirdly the house we stayed at like happened to be owned by him. And she was like, oh, I don't know who that is. I just like the color of this book.
Honestly, that's the most Damien Hirst possible way to consume Damien Hirst's art.
Yeah.
That's like actually meta brilliant, I'm going to say.
Yeah. I'm only putting her like, quote unquote, on blast because I kind of think it's great. I'm like, it was a really pretty green color. And like, it's an art object, literally.
Yeah.
I'm Googling the book.
It's a really pretty green color.
I miss coffee table books. You can't really have those when you have kids.
Yeah.
But I love them. I have so many of them. They're just up on high up shelves.
Yeah.
Oh my God. He's very dark.
Damien Hirst?
Yeah.
Oh, his art?
Oh, like the formaldehyde shark?
Yes. Central theme in a series of artwork in which dead animals, including a shark, a sheep, and a cow, are preserved and have been dissected in formaldehyde. You guys enjoy yourself.
Oh, man.
There were no formaldehyde animals.
Allegedly, Dana.
You know, intelligence signifiers, I mean, this kind of brings something up, and this is a little bit off of the outline, but just reminded me of, I have found a lot of times that when people start talking about art, often, I would say about 50% of the time, the conversation goes in a fun direction where I feel welcomed into a conversation about art, where I admittedly don't have like a ton of deep knowledge. And then the other 50% of the time, it's just going to be an insufferable pontification session by a person who just really wants to communicate to me that they had rich parents. it's like this class projection where I'm just like, shut up. I don't care. Yeah, it's but Damien Hirst is one of, I think he was like the person they were parodying in that movie, Exit Through the Gift Shop. Do you remember that?
Well, Exit Through the Gift Shop, I thought is about Banksy.
Banksy. Yeah. But I think that Miss, whatever the fake artist that they made up,
Mr. Brainwash.
Mr. Brainwash, I think, is supposed to be a parody of Damien Hirst.
Oh, guys, I think I'm finding out right now for the first time that Mr. Brainwash is not a real artist. I thought that was just part of it. Like,
Mr. Brainwash wasn't real. Anyway, I wanted to talk again. Let's bring it back to the intelligence conversation, projection of intelligence. There's another thing from the internet that sticks out to me as something, as to kind of dovetail with something Dana said earlier, because it really connects with some self-loathing I have about myself. There's a reductress headline from a few years ago that says, "I was a gifted child," says 35-year-old woman again. And it sort of reminded me of how, you know, every few years there's like this kind of upswell in gifted child discourse. And every time it comes up again, it's very annoying. Dana, you're sort of like smiling. Can you kind of like...
Any excuse to talk about my ACT score again?
what was your ACT score, Dana?
Oh, I got a 36. It's no big deal.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much.
Is that like
Thank
perfect?
That's a perfect ACT.
I took the ACT because my mom was like obsessed with the college process. And even though I lived in Connecticut and nobody took the ACT, she's like, just take it and see if you do okay. And then I did like just fine.
Or because if you were on the East Coast and you took the ACT and it was better than your SAT score, you could submit that one instead.
Right. That's what my mom thought. She's like, let's roll the dice. And then I think my SATs were better.
Yeah. Weirdly, in the Midwest, we were an ACT people.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I always heard. Yeah. Yeah.
And some of you were perfect ACT people.
But yeah, it's like, I think it like contributed to this like weird self-loathing where it's like, I should be reading The New Yorker and not on Twitter all day. And I feel like I have, you know, my brain has rotted out of my ears and I'm a wash of wasted potential.
You know, the gifted child discourse, I think, is on one hand, it's like kind of, it's interesting. Like Dana, finding out that you got a perfect ACT score was like, huh, that's interesting. That's an interesting thing to know about a friend. But I've also found that like sometimes people who bring up being a gifted child haven't really accomplished much since they were children. And that's sort of like the last cool thing they did. Carol, were you like a gifted kid? Was that something that you were identified as?
I think I was like on the cusp of gifted. I remember always being in like high reading groups and stuff. I was never great at math or anything, but I was on, like my daughter is now, I can already see she's extremely verbal. Like she's ahead of the curve on verbals and talking, but like, you know, I don't know if she's going to be able to count better than anyone else, but, you know, so I remember feeling like the superiority of like, oh, well, I'm in like reading group 5. So like, you know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I remember like, but I never was like plucked out of class to be in a gifted program or anything. But I went to like a really, really competitive public school where everybody was trying to go to Ivy League schools like the whole time. So I never would have thought that I was any smarter book wise than other kids. I think I'm smarter in other ways, but like not, you know, book smarter than my classmates.
Right, smarter at avoiding being victimized by a serial killer because yes, you've been studying.
Exactly. Or like mm-hmm. I was always very active in stuff at school. Like I was the treasurer and the head of the yearbook and on the paper and all that stuff. And so I was like, it's okay if like I'm only getting like, if I'm getting low A's, high B's, because I do all this other stuff, you know? And I mm-hmm. think I convinced my parents that was okay too.
Isn't it funny how much the college search like uniquely fucks everyone up?
Oh yeah.
Like it kind of warps your brain permanently forever.
Like I'm already thinking about how differently I'm going to do it with my kids.
Yeah. Like, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, like my mom I'm the oldest of 6 kids. My mom was a valedictorian of her class, but just went to a school that gave her a free ride. So she went to the University of Rochester, which is a great school, and she went to the Eastman School of Music because she was also a piano player. She ended up going to nursing school and then medical school and became a doctor. My mom's very accomplished and I'm very proud of her, but she was just like, so obsessed with the college search. And like, I started looking when I was a sophomore, and then I took the PSAT and the SAT and the ACT. It was like, I was in like test prep for all that stuff. And I was only 17 when I graduated high school and started college. I think it probably would have behooved me to like take a year off, be a little bit older. Like, I just was 17 picking the classes I was going to take as a freshman in college. Like, I had no idea. And just the pressure of going to the best one and looking at all the lists. And my school published a list of where everybody went to college.
We did sort of that thing where it was like, we had such a college-y school that like on the last day of school, you wear your college shirt and everyone gets to be like, ah.
Yeah, it was like in the school newspaper and I think in the town newspaper. The town newspaper put where everybody was going to college. And like, it would be like, taking a year off. Oh my God. You know, like you would like whisper about if someone was, and if, even if someone was going to UConn, which is a great school.
Mm-hmm. Especially if you play basketball.
Yeah. But if it's a state school, everybody was like, or whatever, you know, like it was so judgy. Like the whole process was so judgy. And I just feel like I'm going to just be way more lax with my kids, try to get an idea of what they want to do. Like not say like, not act like college is the only thing they can do when high school's over. And you know, I don't know, look at more in-state options because I can't afford these private schools because they're all going to be $100,000 a year when my kids go to college.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. But, you know, it's just, I don't blame my mom. It's just that was like the culture, like where I grew up. Like everybody was just so obsessed, you know?
I think gifted kid discourse came from a place of good intentions, but it did end up kind of fucking us all up individually. And like other parents that I'm seeing that are our age, Kara, have had similar, like, they've said similar things to me. Like, people who went all the way through school thinking, like, okay, now I'm going to go to a good high school. Now I'm going to get good grades in high school. Then I'm going to take the test and test and test. And I'm going to get into the best college I can. And, like, focusing so much on leveraging their giftedness into some kind of collegiate outcome. I mean, that's how I was. And I look back on my college choice and I'm made great friends at Notre Dame. But if I were to go back in time and talk to my 17-year-old self, I would have told myself to go somewhere else. I would have told myself to go to the University of Wisconsin. Honestly, in-state tuition, great school. I love Madison. It just would have been a better fit for me culturally. But instead, I was so focused on being like, you're a gifted kid. You got to do this. You got to push it to the best of your abilities. You got to go out of state. You got to do this. You got to do this. And, you know, it's fine. My life turned out fine. I turned out marginally fine. But, you know, when Juniper's getting older, I'm not going to funnel her the way that I was funneled by well-intentioned people, I will say. It just seems like kind of damaging. Alyssa, you look like you have something to say.
Oh, no. I was just going to say that when I was in high school, I think one of the worst things that happened was when we took the IQ test.
Ah.
Because you guys, it turned out that like my IQ didn't match my output in high school.
In what way?
Like I did fine. I did fine. I was a very engaged person, but like schoolwork's never really been my thing. And so between like the honors, like I was in the honors program and I would do fine in the honors program. But at the end, what the teachers would do is, you know, we had the Regents program. And so I was in, for example, Regents, I was in AP chemistry. And I opted out of taking the AP because I was like, fuck it, I don't want to do the work. And then the teacher gave us the previous year's AP and I got a 5, which is the highest score. And so it's like that I was just never motivated by grades, which always made me seem lazy. Like I like the experiences. And like Erin, to your point, I at the time was like pretty disappointed when I didn't get into Cornell, Georgetown, Brown or any other Ivy League school. But I ended up going to the University of Vermont and University of Wisconsin. And I am a great person because of it. I think I would have ended up uncool and not me had I gone someplace that required me to be competitive when I am just functionally not a competitive person. I do my own thing. Like when I took Japanese class, it was because I wanted to learn Japanese. I never thought I was going to get good grades in it, you know, but it's like made me a more interesting person. And so I'm just very lucky that my parents were like fine with that.
That is really nice.
I feel like I'm sort of the opposite, like the cautionary tale where like I was the classic like gifted kid, like pulled out of class. Like I was doing like math packets in the other room, like in elementary school.
Didn't you start like a poetry club for fun in high school?
Yeah. I mean, I was just like a classic. I like tried to get them to teach Latin. Like I was like a classic high school overachiever, like president of every club, straight A student, like, you know, like sports, whatever. I like, you know, applied early decision to Brown. It was like my dream school. I got in and I was like, by this point was like severely anorexic and depressed. And like my college experience, if I had taken a year off and like been in therapy, but I would have been humiliated. Like for that reason, it was like, you got into Brown, you're going to Brown. Like there was no off ramp for me. And I kind of wasted my college experience just being like, well, I'm smart. I have to be pre-med and like do all this. And like, I didn't have a lot of friends because I was like dealing with like severe depression and eating disorder stuff. And like, it really fucked me up for a long time where it's like, then I came out the other side, not knowing how to validate myself where I'm like, okay, well, like, what's the next like college to get into? Like, do I have to get published by this place? Do I have to get a book published? And like, for a long time and still probably now, like I'm always kind of chasing like, okay, well, when I have a book deal, like, okay, well, when it's a New York Times bestseller, like, okay, well, when XYZ, and I'm slowly trying to unlearn that. But I do think like that pipeline, the way it wired my brain, it has not been healthy or happy. Sorry, this became a therapy session.
This is great. I mean, it's like, I think that the gifted discourse and the projecting intelligence discourse kind of, we can trace it back to the like gifted kid pipeline and like, and the harm and danger that comes from equating our own self-worth from external validation of achievements that everyone agrees are achievements. And Kara, you started talking.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, I think that I totally hear what you're saying, Dana. And I feel like it's also because you're in this literary world, which I would imagine that like college and education carries like that's currency there. That's really important. For me, it was so shocking when I got to New York and I was in the NBC Page program and I would meet people that went to Princeton, but then I would meet people from schools I had never heard of. And I was like, oh, say what you will about the entertainment industry. It's filled with terrors and nightmares, but nobody really gives a shit where you went to college. Like it, like the education aspect of it doesn't really matter. And that was kind of like refreshing to me. Like I was like, I think that's also changed my perspective of like how I'm going to handle it with my kids is like, well, what if, sure, if they express an interest in like becoming doctors early on, yeah, that is going to make a difference. You know, it does make a difference where you go to school, depending, you know, for getting into a medical school and blah, blah, blah. But like, if they're like, oh, I think I want to go into entertainment or I want to go into some of these fields where it just really isn't that big of a deal. Or like I had friends that blew all this money getting their master's in education at Ivy League schools. And it's like, you could be doing the same job you're doing right now, having gotten that at a, if you're not going to be a principal, that was kind of a crazy move, but it's a move you made because you're from our town where you, your parents wanted to put a Columbia bumper sticker on their car. You know, like I understand, I kind of thought that that was interesting when I got to the entertainment business that nobody really cares about that kind of stuff.
My husband went to Portland State.
Yeah. And like is extremely successful. You know what I mean? Like
he does great. It's great. He's also very smart and kicks my ass at Trivial Pursuit all the time. And reminds me.
Yeah, my husband's one of the smartest people I know, but like grew up in West Virginia and like went to a school that gave him a free ride. You know, like it's just, I mean, everybody has these different circumstances, but I feel like if you talk to me at 22, I was like totally like summing people up based on where they went to school. And now I feel like it's, you know, I've got a way different perspective on it. And do you still feel in the literary world like it's very like, oh, Brown, Harvard, like where like people want to treat you a certain way because of where you went to school?
I mean, I will also say like depressed as I was, like I genuinely loved Brown. Like I thought it was like an amazing school and like I had a great academic experience there. And like, yeah, like I do get some, I think it's my own like insecurity, but like I get currency from like, I think being able to use it as a shorthand of people to be like, oh, she's smart, like, you know, which is my own like shallowness and insecurity. But I also do think in like meetings with people, you know, like, you know, general meetings, if I say, oh, I went to Brown, they're immediately like, oh, this girl writing about history is like also they I think mentally do like put me in a smart category, which is just I don't have to do the work for that. It's just like a shorthand, which is just like, yeah, I enjoy that, which is a bad thing for me.
Yeah, I wonder if the proliferation of like book talk and like social media signifying of like what, you know, books you're consuming that are like, I don't know, more highbrow. I want to, that's not a politically correct term, but you know what I mean. People like projecting how much they're reading and what they're reading as a way to be validated as smart is a sort of like alternative way to what we've always used, which is like this harmful idea that where you go to school is like a reflection of your intelligence, or the way that we have assessed other people's intelligence before. Because, I mean, it's sort of a, on one hand, it's a curated accessory that is designed to have people see you a certain way. But on the other hand, it's a way to be like, just because I didn't go to this fancy school doesn't mean that I'm not smart. It doesn't mean that I can't enjoy challenging books. It doesn't mean that, like, I didn't need to go to like Brown or NYU or Harvard or Yale or whatever in order to understand this and to participate in this. And so maybe like on one hand, like, you know, books as accessories. I dated this guy once who just had this bookshelf full of books that he like had not read. And it was the most irritating. And like he would pretend to have, I don't know. It was, he was like one of the most irritating people I've ever met. But I think that book talk isn't necessarily just like an exercise in vanity. I think that it's like a way for people to be like, I'm smart too, you know?
I mean, it's everything about social media is like finding self-worth, whether it's through connection or through community or through like projecting a version of you where you feel good about yourself. And I do think book talk is like all you need is a good camera and like a good aesthetic, and you can project a version of yourself that is smart or put together or organized or whatever you need to make you feel good about yourself.
And is there like a possibility too that book talk is almost like a backlash to like what TikTok is generally, which is like someone doing a 10 second dance move, you know, like you can be hugely popular on TikTok by having rhythm and be gorgeous and 17. Whereas like other people are like, well, we're going to take back TikTok and like make it about like things that are actually, or do you think I'm putting too much on it and that these people don't even read the books? I don't know. I don't really know a lot about book talk.
I also will say a lot of book talk is like what probably like Twitter, New York literary world would consider like less sophisticated books. Like it's a lot of like YA like romance and like elves and like fantasy, like that sort of like romance fantasy adjacent things. And so I think it also is this like reclamation of like, oh, we get to feel good about ourselves too, just because we're not reading Thomas Pynchon. Like we can feel like bookish. We can feel like Belle in Beauty and the Beast reading Colleen Hoover, which like you should. That's great. You should feel good about yourself doing whatever you like to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And our associate producer, Fiona, brought something interesting up as we were kind of narrowing down this topic. And that was that having an analog life, a life outside of social media, is now something that is kind of like a thing to brag about, because we've all been so like consumed by existing in this online space and feeling like we're constantly performing. To be able to read is to have time to yourself where you're actually, yeah, you're like, hey guys, look, I exist outside of this space. I have an analog life, and this is how I'm choosing to spend time, instead of just completely sucked into this social media world, which I think is an interesting trend, and probably troublesome to people who own stock in Meta, that more young people are just like, I exist elsewhere. And it's a kind of way to assert that as well. Okay, that is all the time we have. We are right on the minute for how much time we have for this conversation. So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, Sani Petty.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings.
Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
And welcome back. Before we get to Sandy Petty, a little bit of housekeeping.
House, let's keep the house.
Alyssa, let us keep the house. Don't let Election Day sneak up on you this year. I'm imagining Election Day like a very scary entity, like physically sneaking up on me. I will not let that happen. There's a lot on your ballot and you don't want to get caught off guard. Vote Save America is here to help you figure out the who, what, when, and where of voting.
Use their tool to learn about every position, candidate, and ballot measure you're voting on and build your own ballot to use as a handy voting cheat sheet. Next, you can find your times, places, and options for voting and make a plan all in one place.
November 8th, Election Day, is your last chance to vote. Head to VoteSaveAmerica.com to make sure you're ballot ready. Ooh, new merch.
Love merch, especially when it's our merch.
Yeah, there's a new drop at the Crooked Store for you Hysteria fans. Feel and look your pettiest or prettiest. Prettiest and pettiest in brand new designs.
We even have something for the ultimate drama starters, babies.
Oh, babies love drama.
And of course, if you wake up every day to a wave of dread washing over you, we've got you covered. Can Old Navy say that? Definitely not.
It would be funny if Old Navy did start saying that. We can cloak you on top of your cloak of dread. Check it out at crooked.com/store. Okay, the house has been kept. Now let's do Sanity Corner / I Feel Petty, a.k.a. Sanny Petty. Dana, are you going to talk Sanity Corner or I Feel Petty this week?
Probably Sanity Corner.
Okay.
It's sort of a combination. It's feeling petty to keep myself sane.
Okay.
I am no longer embarrassed to admit, like, I'm a huge Swiftie. Like, a full, like, listen to every album, like, know all the words, bonus tracks. I have it on vinyl. Like, I have Taylor Swift merch, whatever. It's been since I was, like, 15, and, like, I'm the right age where it's, like, all of these have grown up for me. So, like, she announced a new album, Midnight. Everyone knew I was very excited. My husband gave me ample time just to sit and listen to it myself because I needed to absorb it. I am very disappointed in the Jack Antonoffy sound of it.
Wow.
I know, and it's unusual for me to say bad things about anything Taylor Swift because there are songs on this album I like. But to me, as like a red folklore speak now girly, this is a bit more of like the Reputation Lover era. And Jack Antonoff has like a very specific like Bleachers-y sound. And it makes all these songs kind of sound the same. And there's a lot of synth and a lot of like that snare hi-hat. And I'm just like, they all blend together and it doesn't do it for me. And I think Jack Antonoff should have a 3-year ban on working on female pop stars albums. Just a moratorium just to think. And I think whatever went down between Taylor Swift and Max Martin, I will personally mediate. I will get them to work back together no matter what this beef is. And I really hope her next album is just like a sort of a country throwback of like lyrics and a guitar.
Oh, that would be fun.
Yeah.
So good.
I just did a show in Nashville right as it was coming out. And I was like, you guys love Taylor here, right? And they were like, yeah. And we were like, so what do we think about the new album? And they were like, woo. And we were like, does it sound like all the other albums? And they were like, yes. And we were like, and that's what you want? And they were like, mm-hmm. I was like, okay, whatever you guys say. Because I don't know the difference of all these albums, but they do sound a lot alike.
Well, this one to me felt this is now getting very specific. It felt like a retread of Lover with some Reputation vibes. And I just think it's very, very Jack Antonoff. Like you can fully tell he produced every track and it makes every track on the album kind of sound the same. But that said, I would never speak ill of the Queen. And there are songs on this I like, and I will be at the Midnight's concert in Los Angeles at the Sophie Stadium.
Dana, look, I do not have the level of knowledge that you do, but I, of course, was like, I got the album. But because I'm always trying to conserve space on my phone, I was like, let's see if I like all the songs and if I should download all the songs. And I listened to them all and I was like, they kind of sound a lot alike. So I picked the ones I like the best.
I that anti-hero song's really stuck in my head.
Yeah, Catchy. It's good.
Yeah.
And I like anti-hero. I like Mastermind. I like Karma. I like Coulda, Shoulda, Woulda.
Oh, I think those are the ones I downloaded.
Yeah, the rest I'm maybe like a little more ambivalent on.
You know, it reminded me a lot of like Tumblr pop from like 2011.
Someone tweeted that Taylor Swift is our last link to AIM away messages, and it was the smartest thing ever.
I mean, it's like a listenable album, but, you know, I'm not a Swiftie. I'm not a full-on Swiftie. I listened to it because I was like, well, I feel like I'm going to need to know what this album is if I want to participate culturally with women in the over the next month. So I'm going to listen to it so that I know what it is. And yeah. So, well, hopefully she takes your advice, Dana. I hope she's listening.
If I could go back to Oxford and get a PhD in Taylor Swift studies, my Instagram would be phenomenal.
Have you gone on that girl's podcast? There's this girl that has a podcast that's like your favorite Taylor Swift song. And
no.
It's like she just has people on and they talk about their favorite Taylor Swift song. And I told her I would go on. But you know what? Still haven't been booked. So we'll see.
I would love that. Whoever it is, if she listens to this, let me talk about Dear John.
Okay. That's a good Sandy Petty. I am going to go next. I feel petty this week. Something happened that really crystallized exactly why the internet has become intolerable. And it happened on Twitter. So on October 21st, a person who calls herself a plant mom tweeted, "My husband and I wake up every morning and bring our coffee to our garden and sit and talk for hours every morning. It never gets old and we never run out of things to talk about. Love him so much." That's a sweet thing that she has with her husband. The replies, a fucking beehive of bad faith. Like, oh.
Outrageous.
Incredible.
Wait, I missed this. What do they say? You're lying.
"I wake up every day with chronic pain and wash my OCD medication down with an iced oat milk latte, but whatever. Potato, potato." Everyone were saying things like, "Oh, how privileged of you to have a garden."
Or like, "Oh, your job, you could sit outside for hours before work."
By the way, you could have a garden outside of a shack in the middle of Iowa. Like, I mean, what?
Totally.
Yeah. People were just so furious about it. And it was like, I don't know where it came from. I don't know why people started piling onto this person being like, "I'm in a loving relationship and experience joy with my partner in the morning and it makes me happy." It just made people so furious.
Twitter's not a place for joy, I don't think, right?
No.
I think Instagram people maybe are a little bit more into like, "Oh, look how happy they look at their wedding," or "Look how much fun they're having on vacation." But on Twitter, I don't think anyone wants to see anybody happy.
It is a misery hive.
Yeah.
The responses were just absolutely absurd, over the top. And I was thinking as this whole thing went down, I thought, you know, we as a society are not okay. Like, people are not doing okay.
My favorite response was someone being like, "I looked at your profile and it looks like you've only been married for a few months. Yeah, call me when you still want to talk to your husband in a few years." As if like liking your husband is privileged.
Fuck.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God. I just can't imagine taking the time to even respond to that. Like, it's not, I don't know, you don't have to fave it. Just move on with your life.
If you find it annoying, just scroll on. It's so easy. You only need to use even like a single finger. You can just move your finger, scroll on, and not reply.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just absurd, the response to it. And I was just like, you know what? Maybe it is good that Elon Musk might burn Twitter down, because maybe the world would be better. I mean, it's good for like breaking news sometimes and stuff like that. But I don't know if the good outweighs the bad at this point. It's a misery machine. So that's what I'm feeling petty about this week. Just like, let people be happy. If you don't like that they're happy, you can just like say nothing. You don't have to be like, "I'm going to make you sadder." It sucks. It's bad behavior. Okay. Alyssa, sanity corner or petty this week?
You guys, I'm very petty this week. Very petty.
Okay.
We need to talk about the number of emails we're getting.
Oh my God.
Our candidates. And here's the problem. If it were just the emails, I could maybe deal. I mean, I can't tell you how much fucking time I spend unsubscribing to things, people I have never heard of in my life have gotten my email from somewhere. And the weirdest, there's some weird things that have happened. One, I'm getting emails from like Marco Rubio.
Yes.
How the fuck did he get my email address?
Oh, I was
getting
them from Carrie Lake. I was getting them from
me
people.
Too.
And I kept unsubscribing. And every time I unsubscribe, it's the same company. So I'm like, you know that I don't want this. And it's like from
crazy.
Freedom Fighters or whatever bullshit. And I was like, is this because I maybe, and I don't even know if I did this, but did I sign up for like a Trump rally to like take away tickets, that whole thing people would do? I don't think I even did that, but how are they getting my email?
The other thing is I have two emails. One I use for political contributions and ordering shit off the internet.
Yeah, same.
The other one is my business email and my professional email. And they've been coming to my professional email now. And I'm like, I have never used this email to donate to anything. I don't know how I'm getting them. But the big problem are the texts. You guys, I am missing critical information from people. Truly. Like, people who text me are like, it's like, hey, this is happening now. Like, I don't just like fucking keep up with people on text. That's not really my vibe. And I woke up, got off of Zoom the other day. I had 9 text messages that are so incendiary. Alyssa, we've emailed you 10 times. Barack Obama has called on you. I was like, listen, if Barack Obama wants to call me, he's got my number. Stop trying with these emails. But like, they're so incendiary. And so anyway, it made me so mad. I keep trying to unsubscribe. And they're also tricky. Like at the end, it'll say stop to end. And it's like, do I have to hit stop or do I have to type stop to end to get off this fucking distribution? But I found one thing. It was my sanity corner, which is that I found someone who clearly feels the same way. She rewrote like these emails we get, but as if it was a family email. And so here's the subject. Subject: Aunt Shelley does not want you to read this. Aunt Shelley is furious, all caps. She claims she hasn't been invited to Thanksgiving, but you and I both know that's blatant misinformation. A quick fact check confirms she got a Facebook invite but hasn't responded yet. Imagine Thanksgiving without Aunt Shelley's cornbread. Nothing to sop up the gravy. Nothing for sandwiches the next day. And we know this is just the beginning already. She's threatening not to bring the stocking stuffers at Christmas. Dad, I don't have to tell you how upsetting this is. Will you text cousin Eliza and tell her, ask her what the deal is? And everybody started doing their own and replying to this thread. I wrote the Aunt Shelley one because I think it was Akilah's favorite. I saw her respond to it on the thread. But it's like, just stop. Stop with the blinking lights. They all look like crazy emails from bad casinos in Vegas. Mm-hmm. It's like, please just stop. It's like, I'm getting mad at people I want to vote for right now, and I need them to please stop. Please.
And somebody pointed this out, that these excessive emails and texts make it harder for the people that are actually doing more effective volunteering, like canvassing, like, look, I don't like being canvassed because half the time the baby is sleeping and I have a dog that barks. And if somebody knocks on my door, please.
You should put a sign up.
Yeah, it's just
that says,
like,
don't knock sleeping baby. I feel like you should put a sign up.
I full on like yelled at a Rick Caruso volunteer. Not like, fuck you, get out of here. But it was just like, no, I'm not voting for him. Get out of here. But still, that work is really valuable, especially in places like get out the vote campaigns and stuff like that. And the excessive, desperate emails are not helping any. It makes me not want to contribute to anyone.
And it doesn't make me contribute to you when you send me a crazy email. Like, no.
No. That's a good one. That's a good one. Kara, sanity corner or petty this week?
Okay, well, I think I'm just going to go sanity, I guess, because, you know, maybe we need a little bit of sanity. I don't really have anything super concrete. I was just going to say that I'm really looking forward to Halloween. Like, my, you know, I don't really care. I've always been like, whatever about Halloween. Like, if I have a good costume, I'm excited to go out. But if I don't, I've spent Halloween's in. But just doing it again with your kids is really fun. And my daughter's just so pumped. And we have all these little parties this weekend and little fairs that we're going to and stuff. And I'm just excited to see them in their costumes because they're really cute. And honestly, I don't mean to be a downer, but I'm like, what am I looking forward to right now? And that's like all I can think of.
Wait, what? She's not going to be a cop again, is she?
She was a cop dog. She was Chase. I just sold that costume yesterday and I did not tell her, but she is going to be a bat.
Oh, that's a fun one.
Yeah.
Spooky.
And she really transforms when she's in that bat costume. And then my son is going to be a costume that some lady gave me for free. She goes, just get out of my house. If you don't want it, you can throw it away. And he loves it. It's a monkey costume. And he's going to be a little monkey and he looks really cute.
Cute.
And I just think it's like one of those things that it's fun to like redo with your kids because, you know, I have so much fun. So that's all. I know I don't have anything super. I wish I could be more petty, but my mind is like dead.
That's a good sanity corner. Did I tell you about our family Halloween costumes?
You told me about Wednesday.
Okay, yeah, I have a Wednesday costume for Juniper, but I don't know how to make her wear a wig. I don't think it's gonna work. She doesn't look like Wednesday. Her hair is like golden, so she doesn't work as Wednesday unless she has a wig on. So I don't know if it's gonna work, but. Our family Halloween costume is we are dressing as the bad guys from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I'm going to be Master Shredder. Josh and Juniper are going to team up to be Krang, the brain. He's going to wear her.
She's going to be the little brain.
She has a brain costume that my mom made her. And
cute. My gosh.
Yeah. And we're going to like jerry rig the like baby Bjorn and like make it look like she's just like in a little tank on his midsection. He got a muscle thing and I hope it works.
And I just walked by Aaron's house the other day and stopped by for a little hello with my
kids. It's incredible.
And that family goes in on Halloween. Like that, you guys are killing it. Like we were like, okay, we're going to get a couple decorations every year and like build up a collection. And these guys are like, have a full graveyard.
Yeah, we got a fog machine. I'll post pictures to social once the holiday is over and we've taken everything down because I like don't want people to know where I live. But I will share it. It's pretty cool. My husband, he really went ham.
Where did he go? Where did he get most of that stuff?
I am terrified to even ask.
Oh, okay.
I feel like it was many places and it cost probably more than that. If I saw it all written down, I'd be like, that's maybe too much. And I'm usually the more spendthrifty one between the two of us. So you know that it's probably a lot. But it is a lot of fun to decorate a yard for Halloween. And it is something I'm looking forward to. We've got like people stopping by and like taking pictures at night and stuff. So that's like kind of cool.
Yeah. I take spooky walks with my kids and you're on the spooky walk tour now.
Oh, well, that's so great. Okay. Well, folks, that's all the time we have. Dana and Kara, thank you so much for stopping by. Alyssa, thank you for being my ride or die. Thank you to Lorena Austin for stopping by. And thanks to all of you, our listeners. There will be more hysteria for you next week. Hysteria is a Crooked Media production. Caroline Rustin is our senior producer. Our executive producer is me, Erin Ryan. Alyssa Mastromonaco is our co-producer, and Fiona Pastana is our associate producer. Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis are the sound engineers, and our editor is Sarah Gibalaska and the folks at Chapter 4. Thank you to our digital team, Nara Melkonian, Mia Kelman, Milo Kim, and Matt DeGroot.
If you guys like Positive America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Positive America. That includes our new show, which is called Positive America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription exclusive podcast that is basically Positive America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothed.
Dan is very busy, clothed only. But along with just getting great content, Becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community, is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.